12 feet from the high ceiling that hung by long chains. We'd shell peas and shuck corn together on the front porch as neighbors strolled by. Yes, she'd sit in a rocking chair, and there was a metal glider couch, too. I never saw her tenants, but they lived around and above. She taught me how to sew and embroider, and I made a rag doll out of Earl pillowcases and slept in a rollaway cot where I could feel the bed springs. This was in the back of the house in a little screened-in porch room. When it rained, I could smell the hydrangeas just outside, and the damp air contained the scent. I'd wake up to look at them and notice how the petals had speckles of soft pink. Like a watercolor brush had sprayed them. Granny was the bohemian in the family, with relatives from the Netherlands. Bohemian was how my parents explained why Granny had no interest in doing things like decorating or cooking or cleaning. She was diametrically opposed to Nani, who wallpapered even the light switches to match the walls and did her sewing in a sewing machine. Granny sewed by hand and painted with watercolors, flowers like irises and tulips. She liked her stories, which is what we called soap operas back then, and the beauty pageants. She appreciated beauty without having to own it herself. Before all this, when my dad was a boy, she was a CPA for an accounting firm called Frost & Frost. She wore Andrew Geller shoes and a fur collar and went to work decked out and ready for business. Once she flew to Mobile, Alabama to set up the books for the branch's office, and when she passed above them in an airplane, my dad and his older sister Peggy waved to her in the air. Peggy was in kindergarten, and my dad was around 2 or 3 then. Dad and Peggy had older siblings that they weren't as close to. They were really wild, and a housekeeper, maids they were called back then, named Mary Baker. She was at the Posies almost all the time. Mary's husband drove a cement mixing truck, and once in a while, if he was in the neighborhood, he would dump a little pile of cement for them to sign their names in. She looked after them as best she could and was a great cook. She made things like chitlins and cornbread and collard greens with ham hocks. The Baker's home was a small shack, located in what was called the quarters, which was made up of dirt roads. You'd park on the paved street to walk into the neighborhood. My dad was born at night, and Peggy remembers walking to the Baker's house with my grandfather. Papa entered the house yelling, "Mary Baker, get your party shoes on! There's gonna be dancing tonight!" He took them both back to the Posey house, where Dad was born, and the next day was circumcised on a card table in the living room. All the kids had a Red Ryder BB gun back then, according to my Aunt Peggy. Once when my dad was 5 or 6, he was taking the heat off his fireball jawbreaker under the water faucet in the bathroom. Peggy remembers hearing him hum a song as she stood in the kitchen. She called out to him, taunting and sing-songy, "I'm gonna shoot you right between the eyes." When he came out of the bathroom, there was Peggy, about 20 feet away, pointing her Red Ryder BB gun at him. They stood looking at each other in a showdown for almost a minute. Then she shot him right between the eyes. My dad walked around with the BB above the bridge of his nose until some lady noticed it and squeezed it out a week or so later. This was around the time my dad had taken a plane with matches and lit the couch on fire. Peggy hit him in the wardrobe closet when the fire department came over, and they both got beaten for it, whooped as they called it, or a good whooping, which they laughed about as adults. Peggy and Dad were close and would discover much of Shreveport together, walking through the sewers in the neighborhood and then popping up and out of the manholes. They'd look around and guess the neighborhood, and then look up at the street signs, which they were barely old enough to read. They also played a game at Granny's vanity mirror, where they'd place the other in a chair as one would stand behind. They'd stare at each other in the mirror, and the person standing would hold their hands just inches away from the other's face. Then the standing person would swing their arms wide as if to slap the other's face and freeze their hands while having their stare down. When they finally did slap, it was the other's turn to go. They played for hours, and the game always ended in tears. But they'd make up because they loved each other, and that was the fun of the game. In the sunroom, Granny had an embroidery hoop mounted on an adjustable tripod that I'd sit at for hours. I'd look at her pattern book and copy the stitches onto the fabric. I liked the back stitch. The needle moved forward a few centimeters, then went under the fabric, pointing through and creating a gap to be filled, then traveled backward again to pull the thread forward, returning to the exact point where the previous stitch ended. With the stem stitch, you wouldn't see the gap because the needle threaded just barely a centimeter under the overlap of the previous thread. The split stitch took the needle through two strands if you doubled your thread and could backstitch along to create branches. Granny sewed a map of the United States that included every state flower. It was made from a pattern, but still. Like Ophelia, she'd say, pansies are for thought. And she liked to paint them, too. My grandfather was named Uri Posey, and we called him Papa. He was born in an old rail car to David Posey and Ethel Maybell Gage, who went by Maybell. The Gage side of the family was Irish, and David's father was too, but the Maybell Gage side was of Cherokee descent from the Trail of Tears. She was several feet taller than her husband and towered over him, according to Papa. These were such tough times with the Depression, and before that, the cowboys and Indians. I liked picturing her towering. Papa's dad was especially tough. One time he put a knife in the fire to sterilize it so he could cut his own tonsils out. He followed through with it, too. He also shot and killed a man who trespassed on his property, which you didn't do back then, as it was against the law, both things. When he went to court, he showed no remorse whatsoever. When the judge said that he was free to go, David volunteered even more information than needed and shouted, "I'd do it again and shoot him even more times if anyone ever went on my property." The judge banged the gavel, "Quiet in the court, quiet in the court." My great-grandfather marched out of there high on the waves of drama. Maybell died when Papa was 13. Back then, if you didn't have money for a hearse, the casket was put under a school bus, and that's how my great-grandmother traveled to her grave. David got drunk and married another woman shortly after, but when he sobered up the next day, he ran her off. He married again to someone named Miss Ruth, that's all I know. I don't think she was a lot of fun or particularly nice. Not long after, when Papa was 15 and riding his horse in the country in Arkansas, he picked up an African-American boy who was around 6 or 7 and called him Smokey. Smokey called Papa Yick, or Mr. Yick. David, for some reason, said it was okay if Smokey stayed as long as he ate off Papa's plate, not his. And everyone in town came to know my granddad as the teenager who rode on his horse with Smokey at his side. Papa even rubbed Smokey's head for good luck when he played cards. Both Papa and Smokey were dirt poor, but they were friends and loved each other. Papa was a great athlete and played basketball for the semi-pro league. This was in high school, and it was a self-made team. He stayed in high school an extra year to play on the team so he could make money. He even had a German pseudonym, Yuri Hans, in case there was press at the game. This way, he wouldn't have to speak or cop to being overage and still in high school. Papa left his family when my dad was 14, and my dad was made man of the house. He had to grow up fast, and Granny took to bed, to use my father's words. Granny even made him get her feminine products, which embarrassed him. She badmouthed Papa because she was heartbroken, and she manipulated her kids with, "Call your father and tell him that you miss him." North Louisiana had a pocket of Catholics, which was unusual in a Protestant Bible-thumping southern town. The DeLatin side of the family were deep Catholics. Granny's aunt was Mother Superior at St. Vincent's Convent School. Eulalie DeLatin was her name. And we had another relative in the 1800s who was a big Catholic, Monsignor John Vandegar. The names sound like soap opera stars, don't they? My dad loved the Jesuit school he attended. He loved that it was smart and strict and that he learned Latin. He was a star student and he found father figures in the priests there, and thank God there was no weirdness. Aunt Peggy loved going to boarding school at St. Vincent's, and the nuns were fantastic and lovely. She watched them outside the schoolroom's window as they rode mules, pulling the plow to grow vegetables and crops to feed the chickens and cows. Then they sold it all to Sears in the mid-60s, and she was rightfully pissed off. When things got too heavy at Granny's, I'd sit in front of the gas fire radiator and stare into it, then run to the bathroom to look in the mirror to see if the tips of my lashes had turned into ash. Granny didn't have separate soap with flowers on it, like Nani did. There was just one bar, the unnatural pink of calamine lotion, which didn't lather much. She had rippled candy and Depression-era glass bowls, which were beautiful, and she had just a few demitasse cups, which she loved to show me. She'd sit in a rocker in the living room and sing the depressing cowboy songs of her childhood, like, "When the Work's All Done This Fall," which she sang to her own children and made them cry so hard they'd hug each other. This particular song was a real guilt-ridden heartbreaker about a cowboy who got stampeded by his own cattle and died right before he was about to get all his work done and make it home to his heartbroken mother, who told him not to go in the first place. Don't leave your mama, boys. Papa would come over for Christmas to receive the bad vibes from Granny and the kids. Papa was at the office a lot, which was the name of the bar that he owned. He married a woman named Kathleen, who he loved very much but died. And then he had a lady friend named Helen, who had a poof of light blue hair, a touch of magic, I thought. When I visited Helen's house, which was tiki chic, 70s style, she served us mixed nuts and bamboo bowls and had needle-pointed cozies over Kleenex boxes. Everything was mostly brown, and I dug the brown shag carpet and rattan furniture. One time she put her hands on a table and repeatedly said, "Come up, table. Table, come up." She said this repeatedly and for too long in the hopes that her magical powers would reveal themselves to us. They didn't, unfortunately. I really wish they had. I would have liked to have seen that. The Goleme genie slippers with the slightly curled, pointed toes reminded me of Aladdin, and with Helen's blue hair, it wasn't a far stretch to picture a table floating up like a magic carpet. My granny and my Aunt Tony Ann were much more grounded. They'd eat on TV trays in the bedroom and watch the stories. When I was on As the World Turns, it made them very proud. "You got my widow's peak," Granny would say, before talking about how handsome Holden was. Holden was the hunk in the show, played by John Hensley. "He's really nice, too, Granny," I'd say. "You'd like him." I told her how, on my first day of work, the woman who played my Aunt Barbara said, "Be careful who you share your secrets with, because these walls have ears." Colleen Zenk turned on the waterworks like nothing I've seen in my life. Granny loved that dish. As the World Turns was one of the earliest soaps. Its first airing was shot live in 1956. She loved Eileen Fulton, who played Lisa Grimaldi, and Helen Wagner, who played Nancy Hughes, both of whom were there in the beginning. I tell her how classy and nice they both were in real life, since they'd kept her company as she took to bed and martyred herself in her 40 years of heartbreak. I told her how nice the producer of the show, Lori Case, it was when he asked if I'd like to get out of my contract early because they needed to put Holden in a coma before Labor Day. His love story with Lily was huge, and they needed to focus on that. I told her how Lori hugged me like a dad and was so sweet that I cried. She loved all that. I didn't spend as much time as I would have liked at Granny's house, though. During one visit, when I was only around 7, one of my cousins got me to put an F in place of the D for duck. And I walked up the steps of the porch and said the F word to all the grown-ups. That pretty much ended my solo time at Granny's. When Granny was dying, she called Papa on the phone. "Does my baby girl want me to ride in the ambulance to the hospital with her?" he asked her. He rode with her and held her hand and was able to pay for the funeral. When he died, he left all his kids' money and my dad's prize coin collection. One of his neighbors wrote a piece in the paper about how kind he was to his neighbors. All he wanted to live for was to be remembered as having a good name. For the Delatins and the Posies, this apple pie recipe, it's really easy. Skillet apple pie. 1 stick of butter, 2 pie crusts from the grocery store, big Ziploc bag full of sliced apples, 1 cup packed light brown sugar, 1 teaspoon cinnamon. Preheat oven to 350. Melt the stick of butter in a cast iron skillet, then add 1 of your pie crusts. Fill the Ziploc bag of apples with sugar and cinnamon and shake. Pour the apple sugar cinnamon mixture onto the pie crust. Cover the apples with the other pie crust upside down as a lid for the apples. Put it in the oven and watch the butter bubble and cook the edges of the pie. I think this takes about 45 minutes. May God bless America. 6. Indie Days. I can always tell the Party Girl fans because they look fun, and some even tell me that they wanted to live in New York after they saw the movie when they were kids. When we made the movie, we talked about giving the kids something to dance to while they watched it on TV. When I was doing press for Party Girl, I met a journalist from India who was so excited because it reminded her of Bollywood cinema, and I'd never seen a Bollywood film. She explained that characters in Bollywood films break out into song and dance all the time, and that these breaks are shot like music videos within the film. Sometimes the breaks are fantasy numbers or party scenes or declarations of love or heartbreak. There's an air of performance to it all, which is why she thought I'd be a fan. And now I am. Sholay is the film I'd recommend seeing first. It's a classic. Daisy von Schiller-Mayer directed Party Girl, which she co-wrote with her friend Harry Birkmeyer. I've gotten a few parts that I auditioned for, and that was one of them. Auditioning feels like my real self has been punished and sent to my room, while my pretend self is forced to make nice when there's nothing I've done wrong. At an audition in my 20s, I spazzed out so much that the casting director asked my agent if I was on drugs. I wasn't, but just had lots of energy and was excited to be there. I was going out dancing with my friends a lot, though, so with Party Girl, I was cast in a role I'd been living. I remember passing Sam Rockwell in a basement apartment in the East Village where the auditions were held. We had met at a reading together at a theater somewhere in Midtown a year or so before. I've always loved his vibe. It hits close to home. Cowboy Rodeo meets Chuck Barris from The Gong Show. He later played Barris in that movie Confessions of a Dangerous Mind and learned a lasso for Sam Shepard's play Fool for Love, a part he'd always dreamed of playing. I forget the name of that part. On closing night, I joined him and his friends backstage for a toast of whiskey, which I drank with added drops of oregano oil to fight a flu I'd felt coming on. Later, they went out, and Sam was still holding on to his role by lassoing people on the sidewalks. We'd worked together in a 1995 film called Drunks, which was shot in a church in Harlem. It took place at an AA meeting led by Richard Lewis's character, where everyone shared their stories of getting sober. The actor's holding area was a room off the large congregation room, with individual dressing rooms separated by bed sheets. Inside these rooms, which were about 4 feet in diameter, sat a metal chair draped with her character's clothes. I remember actors prepping their monologues in these rooms, which struck me as holy confessional booths, minus the priest. We'd all tiptoe around to respect each other's privacy because some of the older actors were sleeping. There were maybe 100 of us total, all held in this church. So there was nowhere to go except outside, and it was cold. We drank lots of coffee, and I smoked outside with Kevin Corrigan and Sam. Kevin has a similar essence to Christopher Walken, idiosyncratic and human. And Gary Lennon, who wrote the play the movie was based on, was receptive and cool and always around. He went on to write for Orange is the New Black and won some Emmys. Pre-Ally McBeal days, Calista Flockhart was there and fully committed to her work. There was Diane Weiss, who was luminous and truthful and beautiful, and Amanda Plummer, wholly, authentically sensitive. And Lisa Gay Hamilton, who was just completely fierce. I was a big fan of Spalding Gray, the monologuist, who performed his own monologue in the film. He'd stand poised and silent, sometimes by the doorway between the two rooms, but mainly, almost always, close to the wall, like an insect. He'd glide around, peering over people's heads as if they were antennas for his own intelligence or creativity, looking through us or above us in his vacuum land. He was never without his yellow legal pads and number two pencils, which he held to his chest while walking and on his lap when sitting. I remember telling him I was a fan, and he showed me his pencils and told me how he always wrote in longhand. That was the extent of our only conversation. Faye Dunaway swept in for a few days for a monologue, and she had a birthday during the shoot. Everyone came out of hiding or solitude, to sing to her in the back of the church. Before she blew out her candle, she said, "What should I wish for?" Her hands were held up, splayed in a court jester gesture as if to say, "You tell me, fellas." And with really good timing, she said, "That I remember my lines," and blew out her candles, and we all clapped. She was touching the shoulder of a first AD named Bert or Burke, who she had worked with 25 years before. It was a long time ago, so I don't remember. I recall he wore a kerchief bandana around his neck like a wrangler rustling cattle. "Faye, don't run away." I also recall that Faye and Bert Burke seemed to have had a past. A rumor that they'd had an affair back in the day surfaced almost immediately because when she entered the set the first day and strode in with outstretched arms to hug him, they were both laughing and he was blushing. She grabbed my forearm years later, seemingly out of nowhere, on an empty red carpet at the Golden Globes. We were both running late, and told me how much she loved Personal Velocity, an independent movie I'd done with Rebecca Miller. She still cared a whole hell of a lot about movies, enough to grab my very arm. Liev Schreiber got the part that Sam auditioned for in Party Girl, the part of the bouncer. We'd auditioned in another basement apartment in the West Village. Liev came in fresh off his motorcycle, holding his helmet and exuding a strong actor's attitude. He acted like he'd just finished Yale School of Drama, which he had. This was before the New York Times said he was the greatest living theater actor of his generation, or something to that extent. He was the envy of so many of his contemporaries and treated the small part as a favor to Daisy, which it was. Liev is spectacular on stage. He later told me that he almost didn't do the part in Party Girl because I seemed like an idiot. Independent filmmaking felt small town, which was nice. There was congeniality and favors were granted if people had good relationships. Michael Clancy, our wardrobe designer, borrowed clothes from designers and friends to dress my character Mary. Vicky Bartlett, Clancy's wardrobe assistant, gave me the shirt off her back in the first wardrobe fitting, which started in my closet in Chelsea. Liev introduced me to his friend Greg Mottola, who wrote and directed an independent film called The Day Trippers, which is a wonderful movie all around. The production company's name was Fiasco, which was funny, since on the first day of shooting, the camera was stolen from someone's car. It was the fastest and tightest schedule I'd worked on during my indie days. It was only a 19-day shoot, and most of the movies averaged 22 or 23 days. There was a scene where my mom, played by Anne Mira, collapses on the sidewalk, and we think she's having a stroke. I asked Greg if I could say, "Don't go into the light, Mom," and he said I could. Liev groaned a bit, thinking it was dumb, and then when he saw the movie, told me that it got the first big laugh in the film. Greg did something really smart, suggested by Steven Soderbergh, who'd seen Greg's short film at Columbia Film School. It was shot in one take and called The Party. His advice to Greg was to write something contained, with not too many locations, and the locations you'd need could belong to your friends and family, who you could also cast. So we shot in Greg's parents' house, as well as in their station wagon, and in Campbell Scott's apartment, who also invested in the movie. We shot a party scene on Liev's rooftop in Brooklyn, as well as in his apartment, where Marcia Gay Harden was hysterical in a cameo. Greg wrote a part for his friend Andy, and we shot in his apartment, of course, while using Greg's place as a holding area since they lived in the same building. Anne Mira, I loved and adored so much because she can make me laugh without trying. She got mad at me once, though, in her close-up in Greg's parents' kitchen where I couldn't control myself. I was close to being punished and sent to my room. Watching her bend over to pull her pantyhose up from her shins to her legs in Greg's cramped apartment with nothing to hold on to but hanging clothes and an open door frame is something I'll never forget. She started laughing at herself, and then I started laughing at her, and then she was laughing at me, laughing at her, as she tried to figure out which of her legs had the best balance. It was like watching a vaudeville routine. It was so pure in its humor, and she was real and exposed and loved every second of it. Films cost money, and in those days, the budget went to the cost of the film itself and the time it took to edit, to cut and splice the film on what's called a flatbed. Now films are made in digital and edited on a computer. I guess it's comparable to doing your dishes by hand as opposed to putting them in the dishwasher, where you lose the experience of seeing and feeling for yourself how the plate gets cleaned. But if it's digital, then the plate goes into a dishwasher, and when it comes out, it's clean, like too clean. So the technical team of engineers on their computers dirties up that plate so it looks real again, or as real as it can, since digital doesn't have the depth of field that film does. The digital cameras now are better than they were 20 years ago, but still, it's a whole other thing when they can push buttons to create the light of sunset. With film, you had to be there when the sun was actually setting. I need to watch Heaven's Gate again. Anyway, the focus and energy to shoot in film, which is costly material and not disposable, made the work happen differently. Everyone whirled like dervishes. Actors hit their marks, made their cues, and knew their lines. There wasn't time to spare. No dilly-dallying by the crew, but horses at the gate, reflexes on, moving large equipment like C-stands and ladders and sandbags to blast off the shot as quickly as possible. Time is money was shouted all day long. Sometimes I'd seen back, GE, we bring good things to life. GE is short for the grips and electric department, the ones doing the heavy lifting and loading of the lighting and electrical equipment. And Party Girl and Day Trippers, this mode was full on, and it wasn't unusual to work more than 12 hours in a day, but sometimes being overtired frees you up and the commotion around you fades away. I was almost dreaming while standing sometimes, holding the focus puller's measuring tape at my nose, the center of focus on the face. I'd release the tip of the tape from my fingers and listen for the sound of it snapping back. All the hubbub would put me into a fantasy where EMTs were trying to revive me. Roll sound was like, we have a pulse, the clapper in my face, and the assistant cameraman shouting, marker, woke me thinking, huh? Marker, Parker, I'm here. Then action, and I was in the scene. I remember Daisy saying, we have 100 feet of film left. Do you think you can do the shot in 2 takes? I remember Greg Mottola lying down in the back of the station wagon recording sound with barely any film in the mag, which is what the container's called. There was no room in the car for other crew except for camera, who yelled, we're fighting for light, as the sun was close to going down. Something else that doesn't happen in digital is checking the gate. This is when the camera assistant would shine a flashlight in the little window of the camera where the film was exposed to see if any minuscule particles had stuck to the film. When the gate was dirty, the assistant camera person would shout, hair in the gate! This meant that the last 3 or 4 takes held in the mag were ruined in the can. Don't shoot the messenger, you'd hear a lot afterward. I'd freak out when there was a hair in the gate and act like a child. And like a child, I'd let go and move on and want to see the hair in the gate, which was not a hair at all, but a piece of fuzz. That little piece of fuzz destroyed the entire mag of film? Wow. They also call independent movies guerrilla filmmaking, but it's more like punk rock because no one cares if the movie makes money and you're in it for the experience or for the art of it. John Cassavetes is probably the king of this, and I got to work with his daughter Zoe in a movie called Broken English in 2006. The first time we met, we hung out in the grass at the Chateau Marmont from one afternoon until 11 that night, drinking wine and talking about the character of Nora, who I played, and the painful and funny stuff we'd get to expose of her. None of that cute shit, Zoe would say. What does she look like when she's alone and no one is watching? That's what we were interested in. We shot just 2 weeks later in New York. I lose things easily before I start a job and, of course, left my cell phone in the cab on the way to meet Zoe's mom, Jenna Rollins. I would work with her the next day in the first scene on the first day of production. I told her, I have to tell you this to get this out of the way, but opening night is my favorite movie about an actress, and your performance was so incredible. She smiled and sighed, remembering, well, how do you think I felt when I read it? And we sat there in silence for what seemed like a while and got comfortable being mother and daughter. Zoe and her sister Zan and brother Nick grew up making sandwiches for the cast and crew of their parents' movies because they shot all those films in their home. There's a documentary about John Cassavetes called A Constant Forge. What it is to forge, where metal is heated and wrought to make malleable. Zoe has the intensity of her father and the beauty and spirit of both her parents. She nurtured and inspired easily since she'd experienced home in that way. She'd hunch close to camera, disappearing with her crew in whatever setting we were all shooting in. I was in her story, feeling more like an extension of her, like an appendage, the fingers to her hands. The woman's touch is drawn to subtlety and nuance, emotions and instinct, and the space of expression between the words. That space is everything. Hal Hartley has a similar scope and places his actors like dance partners with the cinematographer, as well as composing his own music while writing his screenplay. The notes of the music fill in emotions or transitions, and that space says more than words, or just as much. Hal and I have done 5 movies together, and the last time was in his movie called Ned Rifle. We shot in a prison, and I asked him if he ever felt like he was going to be locked up and sent to jail. We were both raised Catholic, and I wondered if the thought had ever occurred to him, if he felt guilty or needed to confess. He was emphatic when he said, "Yes. Look at what we do. We get to make movies. We should be in jail." Seven, Earth, Wind, and Fire. I love New Mexico and got to work there in 2007 and visited the Hanuman Temple in Taos. I was filming a movie in Albuquerque called The Eye, starring the beautiful Jessica Alba. It was a Hollywood movie based on a Korean horror film and directed by 2 Frenchmen. Jessica plays a blind violinist who gets a cornea transplant. The cornea she now sees with belonged to a girl in Mexico who had hung herself after receiving a vision of a horrible industrial accident she couldn't prevent. After the transplant, Jessica's vision becomes psychically blurry because she's seeing with the eyes of the visionary girl. The horrible accident keeps playing in her mind's eye as she progressively loses her grip. Therein lies the horror. I never saw the movie because I'm not a horror movie fan. I liked the part I played of her sister, though, who shows up intermittently to tell Jessica that she's acting strange and to ask if anything's wrong. I was relieved not to know any of her horror, and I got to play a flight attendant, which I've always romanticized. I wanted to wear soft materials Jessica's character would find comforting, and since it was a gothic story, I thought playing guilty was the way to go. I threw on a comfy sweater, but looked too much like a schoolmarm, according to the producer Paula Wagner, who wanted me to dress more like her. I ended up getting fitted for expensive power suits that a flight attendant would never have been able to afford. I was difficult for a day in wardrobe fittings because my character's clothes were less personal, but understood this was genre, and I'd need to blend in with the dark color scheme of everything. I was grateful for the paying job, really. My last film, Broken English, had been at Sundance a few months prior and got good reviews, and I was hot enough for a second to land a Hollywood gig. Don't bite the hand that feeds you, I'd learned, and plus I was already digging the horizon in the air and driving to my music, like Don Juan's Reckless Daughter. We're going to come up to the eyes of clarity, and we'll go down to the beads of guile. Joni Mitchell, New Mexico, went hand in hand. And the expanse of sky was like medicine. I need the wind. There was an Ayurvedic cafe in Albuquerque called Annapurna's, which is Sanskrit for full of food or goddess of the harvests. I wanted to see if it would be my hangout during my downtime. I always check out the yoga or vegetarian places when I'm on location because they attract people who are searchers or looking to heal themselves and in turn others because they've suffered or are suffering, which I think is deep and cool, and because I've suffered. No one gets away without it. An Indian man named Prakash was the chef at Annapurna's. He was effervescent and liked to name-drop Julia Roberts, who'd been there a few times. I told him what Shirley MacLaine had said about her, that everyone knew she was going to be a big star when they did Steel Magnolias. Then I went into my spiel. Why do these movies with these big actresses never have roles for friends? What happened to the funny friend in those movies? I always thought I'd be that friend. Rhoda to Mary Tyler Moore, friend to Julie Roberts, blah, blah, blah. I was still suffering in that gripe mode. Prakash led me to the Ayurvedic Institute where Dr. Vasant Ladd taught Ayurveda, a belief system and practice of balance through food, movement, and the climate or place you inhabit. I went to the Institute one evening to drop in on a lecture, which took place in a small room where everyone was sitting on the floor. The students were writing in their notepads while Dr. Ladd was telling a story about a boy who'd received a kidney transplant from a boy who died. The boy found himself sleepwalking to the village where the deceased boy's family lived, and he knocked on their door. I don't know what he said and can only imagine. After introducing himself, he asked to use the restroom. There was also a story about a man who'd been given the heart of a suicide victim. He reached out to the wife to thank her for this gift. Well, they fell in love. He married her and fathered her 4 children over 12 years. And then he killed himself in the same way her first husband did. Dr. Ladd explained that organ transplantation was not condoned in Ayurveda because it's considered taking a part of someone's soul and putting it into someone else's body. I thought, well, hey, you could get lucky and the new soul could make your life more interesting and give you more of a personality or make you better at math. But it wouldn't be very Ayurveda of you. Ayurveda is more about psychological mindfulness, solutions to illness, which is part of your soul and the diet that goes with it. It's not just about being sick. You have to get deep about it and think that it's teaching you something. It's not a fix-it solution with a pill. It believes that illnesses are part of your karma, your path, and the actions you take can remedy the imbalance. I'm not saying I'm balanced, by the way, but I work at it. Ayur means life in the Vedic culture, and Veda means science or knowledge. It's a 5,000-year-old system, which says a lot. It's a belief that humans are a part of nature. How could we not be? There are 3 fundamental energies to our nature, to our inner and outer life, that are dominant in particular body types. There's wind, vata, fire, pitta, and earth, kapha. Or earth, wind, and fire, if that's easier for you to get down with. We each have all 3 qualities, or doshas as they're called, and they each have different attributes that manifest physically. So, to give you an example, a big burly man carpenter would be earth, kapha, dominant. He's slow and steady and can focus in on a task. The kapha dominant person is grounded and can tell a long story without going all over the place. Let's say you have a kapha contractor working on your house and he's overweight from drinking too much beer, but he tells great stories. Everyone has seen that guy, like everyone's seen a skinny bitch. On a good day, the contractor is doing his job and is content. On a bad day, he's gluttonous. I am wind or vata dominant. I have lots of energy, I'm a small person, I'm changeable, and like to move. But when I'm out of balance, I move too much and spin out and have anxiety and forget what I'm doing. I'm prone to spiraling down or spinning out. Vata people eat a meal at the same time that they're walking down the street and talking on their phone and while they're running an errand. I could benefit from burly carpenter kapha energy, and there's a whole system of vegetarian fare that will bring me back to balance. Right now, I forget what it includes. Fire or pitta dominant people are intelligent and ambitious and intense. If they're out of balance, they tend to be assholes and have prostate problems. Think of the skinny live wire comedians you've seen who do lots of coke and become impossible to be around. Places as well carry a dominant dosha. New York City is vata. Los Angeles is pitta. The South is kapha. I suppose Canada is too. Anyway, I liked the talk. It rang true. It reminded me of drama school and a teacher named Joan Potter, who typecast based on physicality and essence, and would recommend which Chekhov character would best suit each of us. One of the things that Dr. Ladd said in class was, "We never see our own faces. We only see them in mirrors. We will never see for ourselves our own image." Maybe for you, this isn't a mind blow, but something obvious. But for me, it blows my mind. Excuse me, I brought my tea and thermos for some hot water when you get a minute. This is a dosha balancing tea from this place called Premium Steep. I got it when I worked in Philadelphia. It's a local company, and the tea sommelier, Peggy Stevens, is really nice and cool. I introduced myself to Dr. Ladd after the class and told him about the eye, that I was playing a part in which my sister had the eyes of a visionary who committed suicide. I told him I was an actor, but he wasn't a movie person, so he didn't recognize me, and he took what I said at face value. So I was taken aback when he made an announcement to the class that there was an actor in the room and singled me out, which made me feel exposed. He thanked me for the work that I do and spoke of entertainment as having an important place in healing, or something like that. I blocked out the flattery because I didn't want the other students to resent the extra attention I was getting. I wanted to be independent of that. I sat in on some more classes and took yoga with the students. During one class, we all lined up against a wall and kneeled down, facing front, eyes closed, with our hands behind us against the wall, while making buzzing sounds like insects. I heard the clank of keys opening the door, and I opened my eyes to see the mailman coming in to drop off the mail. Here was a room with 30 people backed up against a wall making loud collective insect noises. I couldn't stop myself from laughing, which I did alone. I went to a few house parties and sensed the different levels of tightness and silence that people exhibit as they are suffering. There was lots of looking down while talking. Mainly, though, I hung out with Prakash and learned some recipes from him, like how to cook bitter melon, which is extremely bitter, but once you get used to it, it's all right. And it's a great system cleanser, if you know what I mean. I also got turned on to this stuff called Trifla, which is a plant medicine that really cleans your system, but not in a scary way. I took a tablespoon in powder form and shot it down with water while not breathing through my nose because it tastes like ground furniture. One day, Prakash and I drove to Taos for the Hanuman Festival. Hanuman is the monkey god in Hindu mythology, and he has a blue face and is extremely devoted to his own god, Rama, for whom he'll run errands and move mountains. Prakash told me that George Harrison brought the giant, however many tons, Hanuman statue to America and drove around with it for some time while looking for the right home, which turned out to be Taos. I don't know if this is true, but I know the Beatles turned this country onto India in the 60s. There's a Hanuman pose in yoga, which is the splits as you hold your arms back together above your head to grab your foot. I can do this, not to brag, but I will go out on a limb to tell you that I've had past lives in India. Julia Roberts didn't show up at the festival, but we did, with a giant bag of lentils ready to feed 100 hippies and Hanuman devotees. When we opened the first bag, hundreds of bugs came out. So we walked into some open land and dumped the lentils there. Luckily, we had another bag, and I helped Prakash make dal. We ended up having just enough for everyone, and it was such a cosmic handshake that we were like, right on, brother. I live for moments like that. 8. Vampires. About 4 years before The Eye, I was in Blade Trinity, which is the third film in the series based on the fictional Marvel Comics character. When I took the first meeting for that film, I was like, what's with these vampire movies? These are B-movies, not serious movies, not adult human being movies that people can relate to. Just who is going to want to see people with vampire teeth being all serious? It makes me laugh just thinking about it. I didn't say it out loud to the writer and director David Goyer, but that was my attitude. I may have been wrong about a few things in my career, but who's to say, really? I passed on Girl Interrupted, the Angelina Jolie part, and remember saying in my defense, who cares about a bunch of depressed white girls in the 60s? What about civil rights? Hello? An attitude I remember Liev Schreiber calling self-sabotaging. It's all right, though. It's not like she won an Academy Award for that performance. At my speed audition, I used a paper plate as a steering wheel as I drove the bus. I couldn't pretend to drive a bus by gripping the air, and the plate was just sitting there on the table. I thought it was a good choice, since the character was initially written as a stand-up comedian, but the director wasn't laughing. Keanu and I became friends, though, and I think the movie did a lot for Sandra Bullock's career. I auditioned with Robert De Niro in a hotel room with a camera in it and a taping for Meet the Parents. There was a line I couldn't say, which was, "I'm not your pancakes anymore, Dad." I wanted more lines to say, and the fact that this was my movie moment with Robert De Niro made me laugh and roll my eyes. I remember Mr. De Niro saying, "If you could just commit," and I couldn't. I think those movies did really well, and weren't there sequels? So in regards to Blade, my agents were like, "It would be good for the studio to see that you want to participate. These movies do really well. It'll be good for your career." And I thought, hey, just because it's not my bag doesn't mean it's not my makeup bag. This was the beginning of everybody being werewolves and superheroes and living in Middle Earth around 2004 in movies. Wait. Maybe it wasn't only in movies. I was walking around thinking, what's happened to people? But when my agents asked if I would take Blade Trinity seriously, I said, of course, I'm an actress. My boyfriend at the time thought it was rad that I was playing a vampire, and he was proud of me. He was younger and liked those movies and video games, metal music, and Godzilla. I was skeptical about Blade Trinity, but when I got my fangs, I got more into it. I put them on and ordered a sandwich at the deli and walked the sidewalks in the East Village doing errands and acting natural. Just another reason to love New York. I got on the phone with the wardrobe designer and shared all these ideas about what a 1,000-year-old vampire would wear, talismans of fairy skulls of the people and animals she'd sucked the life out of, multinational monk garb, crucifixes, grunge Elizabethan, a monkey's head on some monk bees that she'd swing around like Betty Davis. I wanted to be a dirty and chic cave woman with hair extensions that varied in length and texture. For my vampire to be moody and nihilistic, yet romantic and emotional. I went to set only to have all this nixed, and I ended up as a corporate vampire. I wore designer clothes and dyed my eyebrows blonde, wore blue contacts, and sported mainly a tight all-business ponytail. It was actually enough of a change to get me going. I was playing the part of Danica Talos, who the Blade Wiki describes as an ambitious vampire whose aim it is to rule over the vampire world. She's violent and cruel, but she's also a strong leader. My first scene was with Wesley Snipes, who wasn't actually there, so I acted with his double. I asked David Goyer if I could say, "What's with those tattoos? Do they mean anything?" Any like that. Danica Talos was deep and dry and tired of being a vampire. There was an art imitating life thing going on with Blade. Wesley was possibly losing control of the franchise to the younger and whiter Ryan Reynolds and Jessica Biel, who both starred in the third film. And even though I didn't get the full story, I knew it was intense because David had Triple H as his bodyguard. Triple H's arm was as big as my thigh, and he was such a nice man. We actually did another movie together a few years later called Killing Karma, or Inside Out, and produced by WWE. He said all he had to do was swing his hair out of his face and 50,000 people in the wrestling arena would scream and cheer. He was surprised how boring acting in movies was, but he was good-natured about it. I remember talking about pergolas and how he liked Splenda in his Starbucks iced coffee because it melted more easily than sugar. And I did too. Wesley and I were both accepted in the acting program at SUNY Purchase. We went to different times, but had the same mentor, Joe Stockdale. Joe told me how remarkable Wesley had been on stage, but was frustrated with the character parts he got because of his race. So we started a company outside of the acting program, which was nothing short of righteous. When filming started, I just finished doing a play myself, so I asked the first AD if I could visit Wesley in his trailer when he was around to talk about Joe and to bring it back home for him, his acting, the theater. The Water Dance, an old indie movie he'd done in the 90s, was so beautiful. Wesley had an entourage of maybe 20 friends, and sometimes at work I'd get hit on like I was in a nightclub. After I got the go-ahead, I knocked on Wesley's door and sat at the table in his trailer. I told him what Joe had said, and he laughed a little. At me? I'm not sure. And I could tell he was in battle mode because his sunglasses never came off. He finally said something like, "You don't understand. You don't understand the whole story." How could anyone understand the whole story of anything? He was taken by the part of Blade, and battling in a vampiric world. Being a vampire leader, I wasn't afraid of either of them. He'd keep us waiting late into the night, and when he'd finally come to set, I'd whine, "Where have you been? This has been so boring, because we've been waiting." He'd give me a, "You don't understand," and I'd give him a, "I know, I'm sure." Being a vampire sucks. I'd walk around set in my vampire get-up and think, I should make a calendar of Danica doing simple things like mopping the floor or playing solitaire. I didn't have a camera, so it didn't happen. But one night, when we all went to a basketball game, I did start a cheer. "We say Blade, you say Trinity, Blade, Trinity, Blade, Trinity. Can't forget to have fun." One day I was acting out on set and gnashed my fangs at my makeup artist, and she started crying. I hugged her afterward and told her I was joking and just acting out. That was a fun day. Then, the next time I flew to Vancouver, she dyed her eyebrows blonde and sported a tight all-business ponytail. Since I already had a body double for stunts, this made the day even stranger because there were three of me there. There's a fine line, I found, between being playful and becoming inappropriate or even difficult. As the shoot progressed, I kept wanting to make things more sci-fi. Like, at this point, wouldn't Danica have developed a psychic skill to open this door with only her mind? So why press the intercom? The idea got shut down like a bat seeing sunlight. There was also a seduction scene between Dracula and me in his bedroom where the wind blew through a large gothic window lit by neon moonlight. It reminded me of a Heart video from the 80s. As my shins caught the billowing lunar blue sheer curtain, and I leaned to catch the wind on my face from the giant fan set up in the soundstage. My hair had been let loose and rocked out as I stood bored and not feeling it that evening. To seduce me, Dracula spoke in that sexy and slow, hypnotic way and said, "I was around at the time of Jesus." And I ad-libbed, "Oh yeah? I was around at Woodstock." I was able to be sexy and serious about it, but the whole scene got cut. I think David appreciated the commitment that I gave throughout the film. Who cares, really? No one. When I took my torture scene with Ryan seriously, though, I got a heartfelt hug from David, and he thanked me. That was nice. Even though we were working in a studio, there were a lot of night shoots because we were running behind by the end of the week. I zipped in and out of town for my part, so it wasn't as difficult a shoot for me as it was for the others. I'd get tired, and my feet would hurt from stomping around in pumps, and my eyes would get dry from the contacts, and I'd get headaches because the dry contacts would blur my eyesight. If only complaining wasn't so exhausting. One night, I filmed a scene in which I had to shoot someone on a balcony while gliding purposefully sideways and shooting a gun through the air. It was important to me that I appeared to be floating, like vampires do. To prepare, I lay on the floor with my legs up against a wall to get my blood flowing and napped using my purse as a pillow. When they finally called the scene, I got it together, ready to glide sideways with that steady vampiric grace and intensity, ready to shoot with my gun. We did a take, and the director came up to me afterward and said, "That was great. But you were making sounds with your mouth when you shot the gun." "Really?" I said. "You could see my mouth move?" David nodded. "And we can hear you." "I'm sorry. I don't know what to do. I mean, that's the sound you make when you shoot someone. I've never shot someone for real." It was my last day, or night, and I got back to the hotel just before dawn. It was good timing, since I was playing a vampire, and there I was, watching the sun come up. 9. The Death Star. I used to be with a big agency called CAA, the Death Star, as it's called in the biz. When I hear, you know, they call it the Death Star, it's been delivered in mid-stride with excitement and knowingness, like Han Solo in Star Wars, and there's conspiracy in the air. Han Solo knows the Force and the machine. He's in on the game and mission. He's cool under pressure. I signed with CAA in the early aughts when I heard they package movies. And the big stars were there, and stars get movies made. And if your agent is friends with someone else's agent, or if they like the same kind of coffee, you have a chance of being squeezed into a supporting role. And that's a crapshoot. What was also happening was a paradigm shift, as those in the biz called it, in the types of movies getting made. Whoa was me when I heard about the Lego movie. I had a hard time wrapping my head around that one. I tried to imagine it. I'm going to my friend's house. They have kids, and their elevator opens to the apartment. I step out of the elevator and see a bunch of Legos on the floor. I holler out, "You need help cleaning this up?" No, I know they made Legos talk to each other. I didn't see it, but I wonder if their teeth clattered. Anyway, yay for the plastic arts and new forms. I went into one of the conference rooms on the Death Star and met with my agents and manager to talk about projects and what was in the pipeline and setting up meetings and what they were tracking. This is agent speak, and my agents were cool. I liked them and thought of them like brothers. We rolled our eyes at the same-like movies being produced around town. They'd say rhetorical things like, "Well, the studios need to make money," and "Making a remake guarantees an audience," and "There's a paradigm shift." And I'd ask rhetorical questions like, "Why is it like this? Will it always be like this? Is it ever going to change?" It's harder for agents to have creative agency since genre films like horror or action films and kid-friendly movies are what the studios want since they make the most money around the entire world. I think about all this same-like and then about industrial agriculture and what it did to farmers and everyone's relationship to where food came from. And then I think about porn, terror porn, action porn, news porn, anything that speeds up our hearts and minds to consume and to remedy a quick fix when there's nothing to fix. It all started with that gosh darn remote control. It's nice to be up in the air and away from all that. At the meeting, one of my agents had a dark orange tan, fresh from vacation, and I kept thinking he used a self-tanner as well as the sun. We all did. I think Ben Day, my point person agent, brought it up first, and we discussed it for a spell. The reasons for the double extra glow. Perhaps to convince himself his vacation had lasted longer. We all poked fun and goaded him. "Are you wearing makeup? There's a streak mark from your tan wipe." I told him he looked like an actor in a cigarette ad from the 70s skiing down a slope to stop for a drag of a menthol, and I lit his imaginary cigarette. I like those guys. It was around this time that I ran into Nora Ephron at the airport, just after she wrapped Bewitched, a movie remake of the TV show from the 60s. I remember that trip because Gracie pooped in her travel bag from the hard drugs that the vet in L.A. had given her to relax on the flight. Valley of the Dolls was a favorite book and movie of mine, Gracie's favorite too, but these dolls were too much. Her eyes were glazed and she was swaying like a drunk dog leaving one of those dogs playing poker needlepoints. The flight attendant was exceptionally cruel and condescending about Gracie's being zipped up all the way in her bag before we took off. So much so that I started crying, and when we got to the altitude where we could walk around, he knelt down beside me to apologize. "I didn't mean to insinuate you were a bad mother," he said. "But you did," I said, and blabbered how in our lifetime we are going to see people's need to interact with animals as healing beings that help us be calm, and especially on flights. They will help people deal, and everyone will be nicer to each other because of it. I know he was having a bad day, but my day was worse. If my crystal ball hadn't been confiscated at the security checkpoint before that flight, I would have been able to tell him, "Just you wait, mister, you will see emotional support ponies on flights by 2018. Now there's a show I'd like to see, Mr. Ed Style, that TV show from the early 60s where the star is a talking horse. In our remake, our pilot is also named Mr. Ed, but he's a pony. What a small world it really truly is, because as fate would have it, he's the uncle of one of the other emotional support ponies on board. Her name is Make My Day, and she and Mr. Ed have a nice conversation about her mother, already winning, who's feeling better now that her master is coming out of a depression and has started to leave the house for walks with her. Make My Day could have helped Gracie when she pooped later on that flight back to New York. She could have helped me when I took Gracie and her bag to the bathroom where the flight attendant cornered me. "I'm sorry, miss, but the dog must remain in the bag." "Really? Because she pooped in her bag